Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, listeners, Becky here. When we recorded this episode, the release of Out of the Blue was still up in the air. Well, fortunately, by the time you're hearing this episode, the fully restored version should be in theaters, and there are multiple gorgeous Blu-rays packed with extras that will be available. So with just a quick Google, you'll have your pick of where you can see this gem of a film as it was meant to be seen. And now, on with the show. A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. In the very first episode of this podcast, we talked about disco and its origins in New York, but today we're going to look at disco's second home, Montreal. Disco's influence on Canadian film in the late 70s, early 80s can't be overstated. In another show Cam and I did together, we had a chance to talk to prolific film score composer Paul Zaza, and he told us a fantastic story about how when he was hired to score Prom Night, all of the dance numbers had already been shot to the beats of the hottest tracks of the day, and they promptly discovered that to actually use them in the movie would triple the film's budget. So Paul was asked to rescore all of the dance scenes with music that was, and I quote, "close enough to the original tracks that they get sued, but not so close that they wouldn't win the suit." They did get sued by one Montreal songwriter in particular, and they did win. But the next time you watch Prom Night, do it with the idea that "Love Me Till I Die" sounds awfully similar to the iconic Gloria Gaynor track. But what was going on in Montreal that made it such a hot spot for disco legends? Also, did you know that they called discotheques "boîte à gogo," which is what I intend to call them now? Cam, what do you know about Montreal disco?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's just kind of like timing, really. It's timing and I think the European influence in Montreal. But yeah, essentially, like, the idea of the discotheque in Montreal starts in the 60s, kind of before disco really hits America. And that's partially due to that's when disco is kind of forming in Europe. So they are getting just the idea of, like, literal dance clubs and discotheques in the 60s. But then it's also kind of paired with essentially the Quiet Revolution. So there's this mass industrialization in especially urban Quebec. And one of the things that comes along with it is discotheques and dance clubs. And then it quickly kind of becomes a sign of being cosmopolitan is going to the dance club. So by the time disco hits proper, Montreal is there early and they're all in. So there's a lot of interesting things like, and you're going to have to, I apologize in advance for all my pronunciation of these various French figures who are like famous. But for instance, the DJ Robert Ouimet, or Robert Ouimet, I would assume, he is huge for promoting disco. And you have to imagine too, in the era of radio, a DJ in Montreal is also going to play to a lot of major cities in the U.S. seaboard. So he actually got awards from like Billboard for being such a great DJ and promoting disco, essentially. And then, of course, the other thing that, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, is the Limelight, which is this massive kind of Studio 54 very early on, 1973, I believe it opens. And it's like a multi-floor disco where, again, Robert is the DJ. So he's both on the radio and he's doing music there. And yeah, so he got the DJ of the Year award from Billboard in 1977. So that's Billboard of America. Like, he was cool enough that everyone liked him. And yeah, like Gloria Gaynor played the Limelight in 1977. So there's this crossover as well of European disco and English language and American.
Apparently
disco.
It was a huge hotspot too for Grace Jones.
Makes
like
sense.
Grace Jones
yeah.
loved it there.
Oh yeah. It just seemed Yes. Oh my gosh. So like, this is the thing I love. So the Limelight had like different, the floors were all themed. The Limelight on the second floor was white, black, gay, straight. Third floor was super lime, where only regulars were allowed. And next door was like a cruising bar called Hollywood Disco and a leather bar. So they also say that like we hear, it was very important in Montreal to integrate the straight and gay scenes, and also like various ethnicities in Montreal, which, if you don't know Montreal, like many places, it was fairly divided along ethnic lines, especially, I would assume, in the 1960s. So, yeah. So it's kind of cool that you'd really see that in Montreal, what you've heard, that disco was this kind of great coming together. And then, yeah, it's... it continues as well, which is kind of interesting. I think we talked before about Patsy Gallant as well, the disco star. I think we maybe talked about that on our disco episode. She was Canadian, and she kind of became so famous she had a TV show that she hosted.
Still plays,
and she
was Prides, kind of, apparently. Like, apparently she's huge in the gay community. Yeah.
From New York to L.A. is her big song, which is an adaptation of a Quebec-like
song. It
is
interesting to think about that influence that specifically Montreal would have in the U.S., where they're, you know, they're listening to a Montreal station. To me, that then makes sense, because especially throughout the 80s and 90s, and maybe to some extent now, Montreal stands for Canada more than Toronto does in the eyes of Americans. So, you know, the idea of when meet an American, keeping in mind I am also American, but they think I should be speaking fluently in French, that French is my first language. Because that Montreal culture was so pervasive, and it makes sense if it's spreading that far across the airwaves. Certainly, I'm sure Toronto television stations would have been showing in Buffalo and Detroit, but radio and music and, you know, a different language is going to have a far more long-term and far-reaching effect. So I find that really fascinating.
Yeah. Just a recent piece of media I would point people to if you like don't understand the Montreal influences, the show Escape at Dannemora, I think, does a great job of showing how much Montreal culture is in upstate New York. Like, just the effect of Quebec
and, like,
on
Maine,
that area is kind of
certainly
fascinating.
Vermont, and I mean, Quebec is very, is the term wide? It's a very wide
and
province.
Especially in the 60s and 70s, those are pretty powerful areas still. Like, the manufacturing is still happening there.
One of the reasons I think it's so transversive, I'll go with transversive, that it's able to translate so well, is that a lot of it is, it's instrumental. So my new jam is Pepper Box by The Peppers. Go listen to that one. I've been listening to that as I write. It's got a great little rhythm to it. I'm very into it. But Gino Saccio is someone we should probably mention. My partner actually knows him, and apparently he owns like 80% of the publishing rights of like most of the disco hits you think of. He owns almost all of it, but like he scored for Fellini, and he did a collaboration with Guy Lafleur. Cam, you're a fan of this one now.
Guy Lafleur had a disco album in French and English.
One of the most famous hockey players of all time.
Oh yes,
it's okay.
He's one of the great, one of the great Montreal Canadiens. Yes. But yeah, no, Gino seems amazing. And like you say, he's, I think, specifically instrumental, which also, the other thing to note about Montreal, which I think the European influence helps, is like, it doesn't go away. There's not the hard kind of cut you see in the U.S. where all the discotheques board up. As much as the Limelight closed in 1980, I think that a lot of Montreal transition to electronic music, like they just use the 80s to go from disco to electronic, which Gino does. But yeah, he had this also great album I would suggest people look up, Quebec Electric with all K's. Quebec Electric, which is awesome. But yeah, it's very fascinating. It's easy to see how somebody like that, and I believe he does almost all of the instrumental music for the movie we're going to talk about well, which is pretty
all right
exciting.
Well, we should get into that now, because the music of Montreal disco stars is a key point of our first movie today. Hey Babe, aka Rise and Shine, aka Baba on IMDb for some reason, but I think it's meant to be Babe, there's just a typo, is the moment where 12-year-old Yasmin Bleeth busts onto a TV performance of a Gino Saccio track, and it's only one of the glorious scenes that make it a must-seen to be believed camp fest drama in the vein of last season's Flying, but it has more intention and heart than Flying. It's just as fun to watch. It's also a movie that stars Buddy Hackett in one of his final roles, and it's certainly a memorable one. Cam, let's talk Hey Babe.
It is worth saying, I think one of his final stars.
Yes, he's also, for those who don't know Buddy Hackett, Scuttle from The Little Mermaid. So we grew up with Buddy Hackett and just don't know it. so that people are aware.
That's right.
I mean,
like Dom DeLuise, you know, same kind of like,
Yes. A lot of TV in our era, too. He was a great guest star, a great supporting player. But yeah, so Hey Babe is a film by Rafał Zielinski, who you guys might remember from Screwballs, which we've talked about previously. A little more high-minded, this film. It's still an exploitation of a sort, but it's more kids' exploitation, I guess you would say, kids' exploitation. So this film tells the story of Teresa, played by Yasmin Bleeth, as you said. She is a little girl who is a hustler. She's a like a latchkey kid.
She's in an orphanage.
We're talking about two movies today.
Latchkey
like,
kid works because she has no home.
Yeah, true. I mean, well, she escapes from the orphanage constantly. So she's essentially seemingly homeless. We actually don't find out about the orphanage for about 40 minutes. And she's living on the street, kind of. She like you say, she busts into this disco. She wants to be famous. She's like a singer, a dancer, and she'll do anything to be famous. So first she busts into this disco thing, doesn't get anywhere. She decides instead to lie her way into essentially a Fame-style academy. This is the same year as Fame, so you get a little bit of that. But she needs money. She can't figure it out. Like we say, she's a part of an orphanage, a truly bleak orphanage. We're also going to be talking about two movies about people in very bleak circumstances.
Orphanage.
Yes.
Yeah. Like a prison. Like a Fellini film. Yeah, like a prison scene in a Fellini film.
She gets thrown into a prison.
But this is the fairy tale and the other one's the nightmare.
Fair.
So you kind of got that going on.
And it is worth saying, as much as she is in this terrible facility, for the most part, everybody has her best interest in mind. Maybe not the fancy director of the school, but there is like a social worker who wants her to succeed, but essentially says, like, if you keep getting into trouble, I'm going to have to send you to potentially, I assume, a youth detention
facility.
That's
what it looks like.
Which is, kind of terrifying. She needs money to get into this fancy academy. Along the way, she's just breaking into places and breaks into an old theater where she finds Buddy Hackett, who is living in this derelict theater. He is a former talent agent, former performer, and he kind of sees something in her and decides to, as much as he is a tramp in his own way and very obviously dying almost from minute one, he takes her in and they kind of try to together make it any way they can,
which I love. Okay, I actually really enjoy this movie. I do not know why this is not like a way bigger camp fest, like that people like what midnight movie people dressing up for this, especially with like the fashion. Yasmin Bleeth looks like young Brooke Shields, like definitely within that vein. And I just think that her outfits throughout the whole thing are just so beautifully on the cusp of like between disco and punk that I'm really into.
There's a
it.
Point where she's applying her makeup in a sidecar of a motorcycle, and I wrote that down because I really appreciated it. It's kind of the climax of the film, and she's racing to her performance. It somehow is, I think it's one of the other orphans has a motorcycle with a sidecar, and she's like doing her lipstick in a sidecar, and I was just laughing. I loved it.
She's a really interesting character. And the thing that, which I didn't believe, like understand, we're going to be talking about another young actress who is like kind of known as a phenomenon. And mostly is known for Baywatch. And soap operas. But finding out, like, she's actually pretty good at playing this street kid because she kind of has, like, big eye bags and looks, she's got a bit of a thousand-yard stare. And if you read a bit about her biography, it's like she had kind of a tough childhood, too. So she suits this role, actually, surprisingly well. It's a pretty typical kind of kid performance.
She had been acting.
She sells it pretty well.
I think her first job was 10 months. The Johnston No More Tears baby. So from a very famous international ad campaign. So, I mean, imagine that. Like, there is no waking memory that she would have where she wasn't a professional, which is actually quite effective in this kind of role, for sure. And I think when we talk about our next actress, Linda Manns, that's also true.
So full disclosure, I contacted Rafał and he was very kind and very generous with his time. So I'm so pleased. And he was just so wonderful. And so all the information we've got today, not a lot of people write about this movie, unfortunately. And there's a reason it kind of got lost in the shuffle. We'll get into that. But all this information comes from him. Thank you, Rafał, if you're listening. Greatly appreciated. Apparently, we have a new name for child actors who we do not care for, thanks to Rafał, which I love. He says, we started the audition process and a bunch of Annies came in.
And when, that makes perfect
sense. I love it because you get it. Like, over theatrical big smile, stare at the camera. And then he goes, and then Yasmin Bleeth walked in, and immediately he was like, who is this? And then she brought in her portfolio of photographs from all her modeling, and she had a bunch of photos in it that were shot by one of the guys who used to shoot Brooke Shields all the time, which totally makes sense. And he was like, this is the girl. And he talked about her upbringing and how she was very quote unquote cosmopolitan, that like came from a difficult family, and she just was able to translate that into this character so well, which I'm with both of you.
If you didn't have this performance, this film would fall apart. And that's both praise Bleeth certainly as a youth and obviously very good direction. My understanding, and I don't know if you talked about this with him, Becky, but Zielinski studied cinema verite pioneer Richard Leacock.
Sure did.
So as much as we're describing this film as disco camp, and it really is, there is an underpinning to it that is very based in reality and very based in dynamic emotions, I would say. And that's where I see a lot of like Leacock, you know. Totally. I would never say this has a documentary feel. It does not.
The thing I would give it that will also tie to our next movie too is so much of this movie is just hanging out with just this
tag
character.
Along. It's a tag
and
along.
Seeing her go around the city.
Yeah.
And agreed. Like that's some of the best parts. And that's some, like you say, that's some of the most kind of verite parts, is she's just doing stuff in the city. And her and Buddy Hackett too, actually, just wandering around.
Well,
kind of
this
hustling.
Is half shot in Montreal, half shot in actual
New York.
Yeah,
I wondered
York.
About
so,
that.
So Alicia, how did you like that 42nd Street footage hanging out with all the pimp? That's all real
of
people.
Course.
That's
I mean, in some ways,
interacting with
I
them.
Think it's reverse. It's a different direction, but it's almost the same montage as Shaft. When he's walking, it's the same. It's the same streets, the same movie theaters. It's the same marquees. It's just 10 years later. Shaft is 71. I assume this was filmed in 79 or early 1980. And so you're seeing kind of the difference, because it is a big transition that 42nd Street and what we call the Deuce would have experienced between those two time periods. I got obsessed with it. I mean, there's also, this is such a burlesque film. And I think if you've listened to previous episodes that I've discussed my obsession with burlesque on film, I mean, this has...
All it's missing is silent film.
Yeah, it has a bit of silent film. Well, not really. I think the film that Buddy Hackett's character shows her is like, more
early
of a Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire kind of early 30s film. But I do want to bring up that it has, elements of burlesque in her performance, but there is a scene that really, it doesn't sit with me so well. And I'm curious, Becky, if you talk to Raphael about it. But and I think it's a completely believable scene. And this is where cinema verite comes in for me. She needs money. Mm-hmm. She's going to do a little performance for all of the very male orphans in the boiler room of this horrible, horrible orphanage. So she's on a table. Yeah, it's like
the nightmarish,
complete nightmare.
Freddy Krueger boiler.
So she does. It's a regular burlesque routine without the nudity. She's got a little like more vaudeville, I would say. And then they won't give her money unless she takes her clothes off, and she does. She had previously been wearing a nude bodysuit to make it seem like she was naked, like with nipples drawn on, I think, or even taped on or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they're like, no, the only way you're going to get our money is if you actually do it. And luckily, I mean, I think she's fully engaged in this when she's caught. And we don't see necessarily nudity, I mean, keeping in mind she's 12 years old. But it was a scene that really stuck with me, because as much as this film has a lot of camp and a lot of fun and a lot of, let's say, jouissance, it also has this very real aspect of how a young girl in this situation would be sexually exploited from basically puberty, if not earlier. And I liked that, because it made me uncomfortable, but I think it's an underpinning for why this film is really good.
The film acknowledges it throughout. And I think that's actually, again, that weird... the social worker, who I think mostly has her best interests in heart, is mostly concerned about her being sexually exploited throughout, from Buddy Hackett, from these guys.
There's an incredible documentary that is co-directed by Mary Ellen Mark, who we recently lost. She's one of the greatest photographers of our age. And it's called Streetwise. And it follows girls who are very similar to this character in 1980. I want to say 1981. It might be slightly off in my years, in Seattle. And these are street kids who are hustlers. It follows one particular girl named Erin Blackwell, which when I was watching this film, all I could think about was Erin. Some of the most stunning photographs and disturbing. One of the most disturbing documentaries I've ever seen that I both love and can't shake. And it is this character. This is kind of the fantasy that someone like Erin Blackwell in Streetwise would maybe have had about her life on the streets, when in fact the reality is, and of course Erin is a sex worker at a very young age. In reality, this is probably where we could see this character of Teresa in a couple of years.
I can see that. I clocked that scene as well, Alicia, as being the moment of like, oh, how do I feel about this? But I like that it pulls you out and genuinely makes you think about the fantasy. But it also shows, yeah. And something I really liked about this character is that she is willing to put in the work. Yeah. She's not just, I'm going to be famous at any cost. She's like, I am going to learn how to dance. I'm going to learn how to do this right. I'm trying to go through the proper channels. And unfortunately, that also means that I may have to, at some point, sell my body to do the thing that I need to do, which is horrifying.
Yeah. She's a hustler in like she actually is a scam artist in awesome ways. I super love the start. She gets away because she gives one of those I am deaf and mute cards. And when the lady looks down at the card, she looks back up and she's gone.
That's a great cut. Like, oh, that's a great cut. It's like a Looney Tunes.
Yeah. And also, yeah. And it's like, that's an interesting part because I think it's kind of implied throughout the action of the film that perhaps if she had have stayed with that lady, she might have given her an opportunity.
That lady actually saw something. She's also the lady that eventually, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's the lady that gets her.
She's
eventually.
Also self-sabotaging constantly, which is really heartbreaking as well, because someone who is messed up like that, who has that rebellious streak, that's something she has to learn how to curb, right? Like when she sets the woman's dress on fire in the middle of that club, which is an amazing moment. But that also is real to me. Because this kid is so messed up and she doesn't know who to trust and who's going to help her, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's playing, like a lot of this is kind of, we're kind of focusing on the real parts, but a lot of this is like an 80s fantasy fun movie with the fun
music. Can we talk about Buddy Hackett and drag, which was easily one of my favorite moments.
That's like, she wants to go to this school and isn't sure she can get the money, and then it's funny because Buddy Hackett really sees something in her, and he is a talent agent, and like he knows what he's talking about. She has pretended her mother is this fancy producer, and Buddy Hackett in drag, and he is not a guy who did a lot of drag, so this is also kind of like unique. He comes and pretends to be this mother, this fancy, but also it's funny because he's still stuck in the 30s or whatever. So he's dressed like Mae West, kind of. Yeah,
he's doing like Lady Blackwell from Oscar Wilde stuff. Yeah.
Oh, yes, he's got the funny voice. Yeah.
Has our darling told you that the O'Briens have had a long time tradition in show business? Why, even I, of course, I was much younger. Boom, boom, Bertha. The bombshell of burlesque. Boom, boom. You're so naughty.
It's interesting. And I also think, what we're talking about with like the fun and the other stuff, I shared a review from Jay Scott, and Jay Scott gets so stuck on that sex thing. But I think the thing that Jay Scott overlooks, and I agree, that scene is icky. I think part of it is unfortunately just like when you're a male director, there's always the male gaze implication. There's all this semiotic stuff. It just feels weird. But the other thing that I think that he overlooks is the fact that like Buddy Hackett and her are playing it like she is an 11-year-old and Buddy Hackett is like 80. So as much as people worry about her being sexually exploited, like that never even crosses their mind. Like Buddy Hackett is in love with whoever the lady is in the movie that is long dead. And this is a child and Buddy Hackett knows that. So when they're like goofing around in a bathtub together, you're never like, skin crawling. You're like, no, this is like a grandpa and a child.
Photos of that might be online or something like that, which miscast this film.
I
do want to give a shout out to the orphans that hotwired a school bus like it's like they're in Little Darlings or something like that. Like, what is up with 1980 films doing this?
They are all bad orphans.
In 1980 you also have Little Darlings with Chrissy McNichol and Tame O'Neill, one of my favorite films of all time, and we talk about it on the TV show, and we actually talk about the scene where they all hotwire a bus, school bus, to go steal condoms out of a public restroom.
But they just end up stealing the whole machine because they can't get the condom.
About that. They just ripped the condom machine off the wall.
So in 1980, did kids regularly hotwire school buses?
I can tell you what I think it is. And what I think it is there is like a big push. Because this is also, these 1980 movies really predate the big teen movie boom. You can kind of say Animal House and stuff like that, or American Graffiti, but those aren't really teen movies, right? So what I think that there is, and why the focus is women especially, is the big boom of young adult fiction in the 70s.
True.
Stuff like Go Ask Alice and The Chocolate War and all the Judy Blume. And Meatballs was huge. So I also think that Canada was pushing like young people stories. As much as Meatballs is mostly about Bill Murray,
it was created
as a story about young people. So there's like, beyond that, there's also, I think Ordinary People is really a teen movie as much as it is
Good
about
call.
The adults. Carney is this year.
Yes, it is. So, oh, I've been dying to see this
yes.
one.
Yeah.
It's something, let me tell you.
I haven't seen it either.
I watched it. Yeah. It's interesting.
So there's a lot of kids on the edge, but I think that was pretty regular in fiction at the time.
Is don't trust men. Like, if I was a little girl watching this, and to some extent, Becky, you and I have both talked about how much we lament not having little darlings in our upbringing, because it was a very hard film to see. And I think it would have changed a lot of how I judged myself as a young adult. I think this film is especially about how, you know, you cannot trust men. You cannot. The only people who help are really are some of the female characters. Yes, Buddy Hack is going to try, but it's the female social worker and the female talent agent, or, you know, I think she's a producer for a television show, that end up kind of, hopefully, I hope, rescuing her. I do love that this ends with a giant, like, Cinderella reenactment. That is really the film at its strongest.
It's Busby Berkeley. He said that's his Busby Berkeley on a budget moment. And I was like, that's why I love it.
Yeah, her dress
so
is amazing.
It works really well. It looks like a music video.
God, Yasmin Bleeth. I hope she's okay currently.
She seems fine. I think like Linda Manns, I think she just decided that this acting thing is not the thing. And I think Yasmin Bleeth especially has just said she's like focused on her sobriety and just living
life.
So
the other thing we should talk about is I think a lot of the reason why this movie works is because it is written
by
a woman. It is written by Edith Ray. That's right. And apparently Raffel met her at a party and convinced her to start writing movies with him. And they had a whole bunch of stuff in development. He has a bunch of stuff in development. His brain just doesn't stop. Mm-hmm. He's one of those directors just creates, and is always working on new things. And it looks like, so Cam, you pulled up that she was working on a bunch of Don Carmody projects for hire, which you are correct, including one called Space Hunter 3D, which I am personally
You've never seen that?
With.
It's Molly Ringwald.
We did it for but it was
really
for
has
you,
been
so
on Hollywood
Suite,
and as of possibly last night, might be coming back to Hollywood Suite. Based on...
What? Okay, well, I will have to catch it then when it comes back. I have a little behind the scenes story about that one. When I talked to Don Carmody, he actually mentioned that movie because the director was fired halfway through it, and then they hired another director, and he picked this director up from the airport. And as he's talking to him, he goes, "Hey, I'm sorry, I don't mean to intrude, but do you only have one eye?" And the director goes, "Yeah, what's the problem?" He goes, "Well, the movie is in 3D. How are you going to see this if you only have one eye?" Which is the moment Don Carmody decided he was going to direct his first film, which is one of my favorite movies called The Surrogate. So there you go. That's my little thing.
Becky, for Space Hunter, just to quickly get out, number one, you need to see it because it features Michael Ironside as a robot monster called Overdog. And number two, the important thing everybody needs to know about Space Hunter, Space Hunter is why Ernie Hudson is a Ghostbuster.
Really?
Because it's a Canadian connection.
Ivan Reitman.
You know, Ivan Reitman saw Ernie Hudson be so charming in Space Hunter and was like,
and Molly Ringwald is super young. They're filming this in 81, 82. Because it takes a while. They wanted to time it for the release of Return of the Jedi. This was going to be Canada's answer to Return of the Jedi, which, to be honest, it kind of was. It was a huge box office hit. That's a total detour. I also just watched a Don Carmody film like two nights ago that's on Hollywood Suite called The Big Town. He produced it.
That
it's
one's
really good.
Eh?
If our listeners are looking, it's going to be on demand. Yeah. Well, it's on demand as the time that we're recording this, but I think it'll be on broadcast and at the very least when this is released. But Matt Dillon, Diane Lane, really burlesque, like literally Diane Lane burlesque performance. Tommy Lee Jones, like just a fantastic film. I love Don's work.
Ugh, I know. And he's one of Canada's biggest producers, if people do not recognize that name. Like, that was a big thing. So, so Edith, unfortunately, like everybody else, got so tired of, things just not panning out. And she went back and now has an incredible visual arts career. She was trained as a painter. That's how she started writing films and television, actually with her husband. Apparently, the two of them wrote together as co-writers. And then she just got tired of the industry and decided to go back to painting. You can see everything on her website if you are interested in her visual arts. I will go ahead and plug that. Edith Ray.
Yeah, and I mean, she's, I think she might be the sole screenwriter on The Vindicator, which is kind of a classic one. Oh, she's with David Preston, so yeah, but no, that's a kind of a, if you know, don't know Canada's Terminator, that's an Edith Ray joint. Yeah, anyway, it was just cool to know that she
But I think
this.
That's the balance of why the film doesn't ever get too icky and why there isn't too male gazy
And I also think that the thing to show it up against, like to show Jay Scott, which he couldn't know because it was in the future, is like, you know, he knows from being a gross guy because he did Screwballs and Valet Girls. Like, he knows how to make a boob movie, and this is not
so
a.
So I should also point out that he makes a lot of these movies about people taking care of each other. So the other one he's really known for is Ginger Ale Afternoon, which has Yardley Smith in it, which is a really fascinating film. And the other one he just recently made, his most recent, is called Tiger Within, which is Ed Asner's final on-screen role, and is also about an older man taking in a younger, troubled woman where she is apparently a violent racist and he's a Holocaust survivor. So it's kind of the two of them learning to figure each other out and how to communicate. So
I mean, I would say if you look at the vastness of his filmography, it's mostly about young women, right? Like, that's kind of, this is kind of a guy who directs especially teen women, which is interesting. Even Screwballs, we talked about, had surprisingly good
it's
women
people
characters.
Having fun, also written by a woman. So I just want to go into briefly that this is getting a full restoration out of Raffles Pocket. He's been working on it for the past 3 years. He said the color correcting was the most difficult part because this is such a bright film and he wanted to make sure that was reflected. It's gorgeous. That final scene with all the whites is just going to look so amazing. I'm so excited to see it in a full restoration. But what happened was, is that he got the money because it was like, this is tax shelter, but he didn't get it from independent sources. He was able to fund $1 million directly from Telefilm and like the Montreal Fund and all that. So then he took his $1 million and he went to Hollywood and he said, hey, is anyone going to match this for me? And Carolco said that they were going to match it. So he got the $2 million. He said that is the worst mistake he has ever made, because at that point, as soon as they got the movie, they started hacking and cutting and doing exactly what they wanted to do with it. So there's two versions. There's a Canadian version and an American version. I think I've seen the Canadian version because it made sense. And that one is actually available for purchase right now on his website, unrestored. But the full restored version is coming
and
to like
iTunes.
That's
the one
that
we've typically had on Hollywood Suite from Hollywood Suite's inception. Is we've always gotten it directly from him. I'd be curious to compare the two versions. I don't know how one would see the American version, but yeah, that's interesting. I'm very excited as well for restoration. I mean, this could be done in a cinema. That would be wonderful on the big screen with good sound design and the right color timing. That'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, you can always get a time machine and go back to the Los Angeles Olympics where this had its original presentation in the Film X Festival.
Amazing. All right. I loved this. You guys loved this.
I think it's worth saying, like, this movie and the next movie as a kind of bridge are also films that came out and were made in 1980, but were maybe not released for years and years, and people didn't know when to see them. So you're going to see a lot of different
83,
times
85.
Attached to this. 83. Yeah. I think both of these kind of got their widest release in 83, but you also see this one played at Montreal
played at
Film
TIFF,
Festival
though, in
84.
So it plays it premieres at the Taormina Film Festival in Sicily, is my understanding, and Raphael will know better, but this is what the literature says, that it actually premieres before TIFF at a different TIFF called Taormina Film Festival in 80, then plays what's called the Festival of Festivals, which is now TIFF, in the fall of 80, then has some probably issues with finding a buyer distributor because of this financial side to it and it not being directly a Canadian film, and then probably, you know, meanders for a few years after that.
Yeah, God knows. But hopefully played on TV forever and still does, thank God.
That's right. Yeah, it ended up on Showcase, and apparently we just played a few. Of course it ended up on Showcase. It played there a few
Showcase
times.
Showcase review.
Sure. I mean, I know Buddy Hackett from this TV show Action, which I think appeared on Showcase, maybe.
All right. So another film that I'm sure played significantly on Showcase, mostly due to the incredibly bleak, violent content, but also because it is full of absolutely incredible performances, is our next film. It's Out of the Blue, coming up next.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Last season, in our Blue Velvet Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 episode, we went into detail on the fascinating life of Dennis Hopper. In 1980, his career as an actor was on the rocks, and of course his career as a director was as well, after the disaster of the last movie. He took a role in a Canadian made-for-TV movie that sounds, frankly, abysmal. Think in the style of Christy McNichol in 1985's Love, Mary, where an out-of-control teen turns her life around after a teacher who cares discovers she's dyslexic. Yeah. The dailies were coming back, and they were not good. The producers were about to pull the plug, and then... But we're going to get into that. Alicia, is it better to burn out than to fade away?
I mean, according to the ending of the film, it's better to burn out. And we will not spoil this film, because I think this is a very underappreciated, underseen masterpiece. I'm going to say that. It absolutely is. It is a masterpiece. So we won't give it away, but I mean, I think if you just read the plot of the film, you can probably guess that it's not a happy ending. This was a film that was actually started out as a film called The Case of Cindy Barnes. It was going to be like you said, a made-for-TV movie, very cheesy. It was written by Leonard Yacker as well as his partner at the time, and it was going to be directed by Leonard Yacker. He starts filming it in, this is really set in Vancouver. We talk a lot about Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains is a really great Vancouver film, and it is. Out of the Blue is like, if you grew up in British Columbia, and specifically Vancouver, my goodness, this is like probably the bowling alley that you went to in the 1980s. This is probably the movie theater that you went to. Like, it really is a lost Vancouver that I was so delighted to see. He starts filming it, and 3 weeks in, it becomes incredibly clear that he's not competent. And he has, I think, talked about this. Like, it's not like someone told him, you suck, you got to get out. He just knew he couldn't do this. And that's primarily because of the two stars, Dennis Hopper, but even more so, the rawness of Linda Manns. Linda Manns, I hope our listeners know, is the young girl from Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. Both in this case of the film Out of the Blue and Days of Heaven, she was meant to have a much smaller role and then somehow becomes the star of both films entirely by improvising dialogue and just almost free association speech. Days of Heaven, all of those monologues that she has, the voiceovers, which structure the entire film, were never in the screenplay. And were actually a case of Malick just asking her to start talking, just start rambling, say anything. And she starts talking, that becomes the entire thesis of Days of Heaven. And lo and behold, she does it again just 2 years later with this film where she really takes it over. So something that was meant to be an after-school special called The Case of Cindy Barnes becomes Out of the Blue, one of the most nihilistic but realistic portrayals of... childhood abuse and alcoholism and drug addiction and growing up on the fringes of society that I've seen in a long time. I'm not even saying what the plot is. Sorry. I will talk about the plot now.
I loved it too, Alicia. I'm with you. It's on my list of movies I never want to see again, but I am very glad I have.
I can see myself watching a lot to try to wrap my head around it, but I'm so glad that it wasn't spoiled for me going into it. And this is a film that my partner and I have tried to seek out for years, and we were going to wait until this glorious promised restoration, which my understanding is did play in Venice recently and did play in Vancouver.
It's heard However, it played in Vancouver.
Has no plans to come out commercially and is not shown anywhere in the Eastern Seaboard, and I will talk later about why, because it comes down to copyright. And, you know, we ended up having to watch a crappy file. And even then, it blew me away. But Cindy Barnes is nicknamed CB, not only because it's her initials, but because she's the daughter of a truck driver, Dennis Hopper. The opening of the film is we find out a flashback to CB in the truck with her father, who is drinking. And he crashes his truck horrifically into a school bus and kills dozens of children in a small town. He goes to prison for, I believe, 5 years, which seems like a...
They get him for manslaughter. That's why he pleads guilty, and they get him on manslaughter, which is one of those things.
I would also assume, honestly, in this era, that drunk driving is just not a factor. Yeah, like impaired driving charges probably don't exist.
I want to be clear that this bus sequence, which if you've seen The Suite Hereafter, this is 25 times what that is.
Yep.
It is the most alarming opening to a film I can think of in recent memory. I assumed it was a fantasy sequence because we do see her 5 years later wake up sweating like she's had this as a nightmare. But no, this has really happened.
Yeah. And it's worth, like, PTSD style, this recurs throughout the film just because she'll randomly kind
of be
attacked.
I don't, this, what I'm going to say is very graphic, so I do want to warn listeners. It's not just like, oh, truck barrels into a school bus. It is so terrifyingly orchestrated that you see the bodies of children fall out of the bus. You see them being dragged. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's dummies, but it looked real.
It's why it works is because it's Halloween and all the kids are dressed in costumes, so the dummies kind of have these costumes.
Very smart.
And
on the part of Dennis Hopper, great director, very smart. And so we really meet CB. She's, I believe, 12 or 13 years old, and she is excited because her dad's going to be released from prison. She hasn't been able to visit her father while he was incarcerated, except for like maybe a week before he's being released. Her mother is a waitress, struggling, obviously, with heroin addiction, and she really believes that her father coming home is going to solve everything, that they're going to be a family again. She's very into the punk scene, which this, if you have a knowledge of Vancouver punk in the late 70s and early 80s, of which I do not, to kind of look it up, I think it's probably a really important film because you're getting performances by kind of this iconic Vancouver punk band called The Pointed Sticks. At one point with Linda Mann's even playing drums to one of their performances. She's Linda Mann. If you've never seen Linda Mann's, she is... one of the most visually arresting actresses I can think of. She's
magnetic. Magnetic is the only word you can use for her, really.
She's so childish. You know, she doesn't have a womanly body for her age, yet she is so much older than her years. She has natural scarring on her face, which is very convenient for the film because she was injured in this truck and bus accident. But I could stare at her for hours. She's just unsettling. And this film is just a roller coaster ride of what her life is. And it's almost all downs. There's no ups, really. And the reality of Dennis Hopper and this performance, I think he said he believes it's one of his best. He's definitely said that he feels this is his best film, that this is the true sequel to Easy Rider from 69. It's not the last movie, which we can talk about. Last movie's insane. But this is truly his best work.
We'll get to it on the podcast.
And I
I'm
agree.
Sure.
Yeah. I think it's... I'm just astonished. I'm astonished by this film. I want everyone to watch it, but then I'm also very scared for people to watch it. And Hopper, you know, it was really on the fringes of society at this point with his own addictions. It's so believable as he becomes the villain in this film.
Well, let's get into that a bit, Cam, because both you and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole of where he was at in his addictions. This is right before he went to rehab, before he had the Hopper stalls in 1983. Cam, what was going on here? There's some interesting stuff.
Well, I mean, he was going around shopping a sequel to Easy Rider, which is also, I think, why he considers this that, called Biker Heaven, which was about, I believe, aliens come down and pull him and Captain America out of a swamp, and it's a lesbian-controlled future apocalypse. It sounds insane and not good. But what he was interested in and why he considers this part of it is, like, what would these guys be like? And I think the interesting thing that comes out of it is, in spite of the fact that he was in the throes of addiction, he realizes that those guys would probably be a piece of shit. Like, those guys would suck.
And there's no sympathy for these people at all. They are played horrifically.
And him saying that he thinks that probably those cool characters.
Yeah, they'd go from
Easy
taking
Rider
amazing, like,
cool
mind-expanding psychotropic drugs. Is that the word? Psychotropic? No.
Yeah.
Psychotropic.
Psychotropic.
You can tell how much LSD I've done in my life. And, you know, they would then just be fucking strung out heroin addicts, unable to feed their children in the 1980s.
Yeah. So. Where else he was he was at, like, full chaos. I mean, obviously he's coming off of Apocalypse Now. Certain people knew how to work with him, and he'd put in some really great performances recently, but he was so out of control that probably what you want to talk about is the film Human Highway, the Neil Young film, which is kind of famously a mess and famously hard to see too. But I think it's recently had a restoration and is kind of coming back. It co-stars Devo, we're saying, and he had a small role as a chef, and as Mark Mothersbaugh put it, Dennis Hopper's drug-induced mania, he couldn't say his lines, he couldn't speak his sentence, he just ignored every direction he got. He was a short-order cook in the movie, and he was playing with a knife, and it ended up cutting Sally Kirkland bad. And part of the reason he was in Canada was because Sally Kirkland was suing him for stabbing her, and he fled to another country. That's why he agreed to do this dumb movie. And also his friend, Paul something, who's one of the producers, essentially used this movie to extradite out of the country to get away from stabbing Sally Kirkland.
The other thing that happened with this, which is interesting, is that because he took over as director, this film could not be used for the Canadian tax credit. So it went from making
all its money
to no money whatsoever immediately.
And it's also part of the reason why it does so well at Cannes. But it doesn't have distribution set up. So that's part of the reason why this kind of falls into obscurity.
This was a sensation at Cannes, and I want to really, really focus on that, because you're going to read some articles on this film that say it bombed. It didn't. I've read more, like, first-person accounts from people that I trust, such as, let's just say, Roger Ebert, who was like, this was going to be the biggest sale at Cannes of 1980. And it was absolutely just assumed that Linda Manns would be nominated for Best Actress, not Best Supporting, but Best Actress, that this would, and she would win it most likely. I think 1980 would be Sissy Spacek for Coal Miner's Daughter.
That sounds right.
You're right.
It really was successful, but you're right. They screwed up the very insane minutia of what makes it a Canadian tax shelter film.
Well, kind of the mega OSHA of getting rid of the Canadian director and
all
putting an American in the director's
chair. All the majors, so people who are not aware, all of the major
every major actor
and all
is
the major
Canadian.
Like production and people
you
all
could,
have to be Canadian.
I mean, there are, but, okay, wait a minute, though. There are other Canadian films that were tax shelter films with American directors. Think about, like, The Silent Partner in 1978.
Yes, but you would have to have a lot of Canadian actors,
it's
which
true.
This does not have. This has very few. Raymond Burr is essentially it.
Raymond Burr is he was largely written out of it, like you're saying, but that he also got pissed and then renounced
him
his
and
Canadian
Hopper
citizenship as a result of this film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Raymond Burr is... There is a Raymond Burr theater in Vancouver, but yeah. And it's also interesting because, I mean, you hear about... It's interesting because you're essentially getting so many sources, like I'm sure you have had to. I was kind of interested because a lot of the sources say that, like, Leonard Yekir is, like, an inexperienced director, but it's like he had a pretty famous movie in 1975.
Well, that's what
so
I'm
it's
saying.
Not like
Why
he's
didn't
nobody.
They just have Dennis secretly direct it?
Well, no, and I think you're right. The restoration guy has a good talk about it, and he's like, he just thinks that the Linda Mann's style was so different. So I think that, like you say, Leonard Yekir kind of stepped away, and I also think that, like I say, the one of the producers was a Hopper best friend who knew how to work with Hopper. And the other thing is, like, you hear a lot of the roles. I don't know. Do you guys know that Paul, the boyfriend that runs the diner, is not an actor? He's actually the production designer and with a pseudonym. So it's obviously somebody, again, who could handle Hopper and deal with Hopper, stepping in and playing a one of the
He's
main
good.
Five roles.
Well,
basically.
Sharon Farrell, who plays the mother, like this is just a incredible cast of like fascinating human
you
being.
You have this quote right from
yes.
her.
I've got it. Okay, so people who aren't familiar with Sharon Farrell, she was wooed by a young Che Guevara when she was in Cuba making Kiss Her Goodbye in 1959. She dated Bruce Lee on the set of Marlowe and hung out with Peter O'Toole on The Stuntman, which we're going to be talking about. And her quote is, first we started with a beer and a joint. Everybody stoned, everybody's drunk, everybody partied, but that was back when everyone was doing it too. It was like today with crews carrying bottled water. So this was just like a massive party on this set the whole time. That's how they started their days.
I've got a better quote than where she's like, she loves it. She says it's a great movie, again, but she's like, how do you respect somebody who's running around on a motorcycle late for every scene because he's shooting somewhere or shooting up somewhere? Then he comes in, he's all excited, he's late, but he's got a great big pile of cocaine. So we go all in. We give him $100 for a gram. He was our director, our writer.
That's more dramatic. So there's that. And so Richard Linklater also of like Dazed and Confused and Boy, like the famous director. You can definitely see how he would be a big fan of this because it has that very much slice of life one day sort of thing that he loves and that he does. And so he went to the original screening of this in Houston, I believe it was in Houston, to introduce it, Dennis Hopper had made this absolutely bonkers video of himself in a room.
After the fact, he made a crazy video. Him and Wim Wenders, Alicia,
need
to which you would appreciate.
Sit in a dark room and contemplate.
Well, him and Wim Wenders come, and he like makes a purpose. The way Linklater describes it, and you can find him describing this, he made a purposefully confrontational, crazy video to essentially clear out the audience and see who is like the Dennis Hopper
the
real
diehards.
Heads. And then, the diehards. And then he's like, all right, guys, we're going to a party. Like, he kept announcing that there was a party after. And Linklater was
Linklater
like,
would have been a kid.
This
is 1980.
Part.
He would have been like,
he was a teenager.
Yeah, I was gonna say 17
I believe
years
he
old.
Was a teenager. Yeah. I think that this screening was in 1983. Yes. It was post can. Yes. Post-can, pre-sobriety, though, because so what happens is he essentially takes them to, in a school bus, he keeps saying there's a party, nobody really believes it.
So the room clears from
300
people to like,
to like 10
or 20, real small.
He takes them on a school bus to the end of a demolition derby, like to the sticks of Texas, to a motor speedway. He goes to something that he calls the Russian Dynamite Death Chair, where it is a chair literally surrounded by a circle of dynamite.
If the dynamite
all goes off perfectly, there is a vacuum and you are protected. Yeah. If anything goes wrong, you are blown up by dynamite. So Dennis Hopper does it, pulls off the stunt, Evel Knievel style.
And he comes out, Richard Linklater does a Dennis Hopper impersonation going like, I did it, I survived death! It's crazy.
And I will tell you, if you put into YouTube Dennis Hopper's Russian Dynamite Death Chair, you can see footage.
He survives, which makes it okay. But oh man.
Yes, he survives. And as Becky and I know from our research too, he immediately goes to the jungle, does too much acid, and the mix of the Russian Dynamite Death Chair and this jungle trip is what
Houston
makes him decide to be
jungle.
Sober.
He also went to the jungle.
He was shooting a movie.
They couldn't find him for
again,
years.
A movie that was not in North America. So he goes to the jungle in South America in order to do this other film.
But listen, you can at least appreciate that blowing yourself up with dynamite. He's like, man, I can get
so. And do Texas Chainsaw Massacre too. As
anyway,
my career comeback.
Exactly.
And Blue Velvet. Yeah, that's
a
right.
Fun side story, but just like what the state, and I also think that's the state because he really wrote this with Linda Manns, which is, and that's also actually what the great producer who's involved in the restoration talks about, is he thinks that the fight that Leonard E. Kier and Linda Manns had was just Linda Manns wasn't interested in TV movie style movie, and then Dennis Hopper realized, I'll just write this movie around who Linda Manns is. But also the interesting thing is the producer often goes out of his way to say a lot of stuff that's credited to Hopper was weirdly in the original script. He's like, her obsession with Elvis, that jacket, that is all part of the original script. But I think, and like we talked about, the beautiful footage of her just wandering around Vancouver,
Street,
interacting with weirdos. On Hastings Street, on Granville, the weird Elvis guy that she just runs into in Chinatown. And then also what you were talking about, the great punk stuff. And I mean, it's kind of fascinating, like you say. It's this weird thing where she's obsessed with punk, but also in a really kid way where it's like, mm-hmm. do you even get what you're saying? She's just kind of like parroting dialogue. But then, yeah, there's a wonderful interview with the lead singer of the Pointed Sticks, who also says, you know, they were told to start a show at 6 p.m. and Dennis Hopper didn't show up till midnight. So he's like, all the kids were drunk and passed out, but I guess
Hastings
that's probably
State
what he wanted.
Which is a pretty famous.
I think so.
And you also getting really great scenes of the Varsity Ridge Bowling. Like, I started looking all the locations up, most of which have been bulldozed, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
I think the movie theater might still be standing, but isn't a movie theater.
Yes, the movie theater.
It's a performing
It's not a movie theater anymore.
Like that,
but it was. Yeah. It was the big Cineplex for a while.
Yeah, so did Brendan, my partner watching it from Port Moody. He was like, oh my God, like, I know that lobby.
It was the big downtown one, even when I lived there.
We talked about the restoration and it being seen, and we talked about this being seen in the first place and not getting distributors. And apparently, have you guys heard of Jack Nicholson's Favor Notebook?
I'm all too scared to ask for context.
this is my new favorite thing. So I watched an interview with the producer, I believe, the same one Cam's talking about. It's a current one where he talked about they were trying to get people to see this. So he's like, can you get Jack Nicholson to talk about this movie? I know he's your buddy. And Hopper's like, I can't do that. Because he's got this little book and he has all of his friends' names written in it. And once you ask him for a favor, he crosses that name out and
but
you never get
Nicholson
another favor.
Nicholson did speak about this film.
But Nicholson did speak about this film. Yeah. That was the favor. So apparently they went for a lost weekend hang at Jack Nicholson's, and the result of which was he did
a radio ad for them endorsing it. I might be so naive. Like, I was reading Jack Nicholson's comments on this film, and I believe what Jack Nicholson is saying. I don't think this is like, let's push this crappy film that Dennis Hopper made. And I think genuinely there are people who saw this. They just didn't have enough power. And also, this film is too tough for people.
Yeah,
it's a rough. I understand, like, as much as they're saying it's like various machinations of tax shelter. I think
agree.
I could also just see it having a tough sale because it's
tough.
It's a tough movie to sell at all. Like, and I even feel almost the same way about Hey Babe. Like, it's got both of these are kind of confrontational, and it's worth saying trigger warning for both movies with the sexual elements.
Something like Little Darlings
and
Adrian Lyne's Foxes, which is so similar to Out of the Blue. And Foxes is same year, 1980, starring Jodie Foster in one of her kind of her last role before she becomes a full time student at Yale and takes a break. And Sherry Curry from The Runaways.
These two films
could have gone together really well, but we wanted to do Hey Babe because it's Canadian. You know, this idea like that Foxes and Little Darlings are safer films because there's more packageable stars
and there's a moral to the end of Foxes. Yeah. There's people are punished things like that, right?
Sherry doesn't blow herself up.
She dies from a car accident,
but it's because
she's hitchhiking. You deserve to die. Whatever. But and Little Darlings, they realize that sex is important and they're friends. Not to slight Little Darlings. This film, thinking about what's going on in 1980 and how we think of young girls and how we're hiding how much sexual exploitation there is, how we're hiding issues with child abuse coming up in the school system where it's like, oh God, well, we're pretty sure she's being abused. Don't even send her to the counselor. Like, it's a different time where it's like, we don't want to talk about this. We know it's happening. We know it's pervasive, but we don't want to talk about it. And for lack of a better term, Dennis Hopper blows it up. I don't know what distributor would have taken this on. I really don't.
I saw a good article that was linking this film kind of ideologically from essentially the kind of realist stuff you're talking about to what would
I was gonna
be
say Harmony Korine is where this
Korine
is really gonna
90s.
Survive
no
yeah
And
that's
Larry Clark.
And you get that because that was also tough to distribute tough to distribute kind of intense in your face stuff about things that are happening in society.
I mean,
you
this should
really
have been,
want to watch a movie.
This should have been at Sundance. And it's just in 1980, this obviously couldn't have been at Sundance.
Had this come out in like the early 90s of that time, like we're talking the Tarantino Linklater era, this would have won every award that was out there. This would have been nominated for Oscars. It makes so much sense.
Specifically 1980. It couldn't have come out in the early 90s. It was a different time. Yeah. That man's performance would have had a different context. Hopper was, you know, making really great erotic thrillers with Jodie Foster in the 90s, which I love. That took place in Mexico.
God, yes.
This is absolutely a film that is about youth culture in 1980, about the punk scene, about how we just didn't understand childhood and we were not paying attention.
And nobody's listening. That scene where she is like, she comes in late and just the way she's treated by the teacher is just another problem. And you're like, this kid's messed. Like, how are you missing all of these red flags?
The film, Streetwise. Released in 1984, but I believe some of the footage was started as early as 1980. And even that film, that was like one of the first films that was like, hey, did you know that there's like 13-year-old kids selling their bodies, living on the streets?
Sure.
And like, we aren't talking about it as a society.
And I mean, if you want to get Vancouver, Hookers on Davies, 1984 as well, which is also like a seminal, pardon the pun, work by Janis Cole and Holly Dale, which I think has been recently restored as well. So it's weird. And I know what you mean. And the other thing that's interesting is, like, number one, I guess it's easy to get caught up in because Hopper's such a big character that, like, it's fascinating that he was still so, like, he made a great movie when he was at his lowest. Like, this is pretty much it. And then also that he was still actually quite in touch with the zeitgeist. I think what he was able to do, and it's what you know about him as an art collector and stuff too. Like, he was still able to look around him and understand. And that's why this is a fascinating Vancouver movie too, is that, and maybe, who knows how much is set up. Again, this producer is always clear to say, like, a lot of these locations, a lot of whatever
Beijing,
was set up before Hopper took over. But he knew, he knew where to film. He knew how to find these random people. He found the punks that were the actual top punk band in the city, you know?
And that's such a, like, stupid term. Because, but the magic, there's a magic.
It's electric.
And that magic trick is where the film begins.
Yeah.
I think I kind of know where it's going. And it's going to be really tough, but I kind of get it. And then the way the film ends, it puts me on kind of in a firing squad for, like, how dare you think in the beginning we were going to go that way? That's how stupid and naive and out of touch you are with really what's happening.
And also, you thought you were safe.
Yeah.
You thought you were safe sitting down to watch this movie, and you're
safe.
Not. Yeah.
And I mean, the other thing is, it absolutely, like, I guess I kind of implied before, it drags Hopper through it. Like this is not a movie that makes Dennis, like, and it, like he says, I mean, they show old photos of him and he's dressed like Easy Rider, Wild One, sort of like a biker. So I think it's him purposefully kind of dragging his own image through the mud.
I mean, luckily so few people saw it, but
no.
And it would take, as you said, Becky, the Dennis Hopper essence occurs in 1986, which is the subject of one of our episodes from second season. Yeah. And he's nominated for an Academy Award in 86, but, you know, it takes 6 years between Out of the Blue and that to happen. And in the in-between is a dark, dark, dark place that only someone who made this film would know is going to happen to them.
It makes all the sense in the world that Chloe Sevigny and Natasha Lyonne are the ones who are spearheading the restoration, and that Chloe Sevigny owns the Elvis jacket, which she bought off Linda Mance.
We haven't even said this. We lost Linda Mance last year. And that was, you know, she was in her early 60s. I believe she passed from cancer or pneumonia related to cancer. That hit me. Like, that hit me hard. And I hadn't seen this film yet. It really was just hit me on the basis of her starring in The Wanderers from 1979, directed by Philip Kaufman. And, of course, Days of Heaven, which is a Hollywood Suite favorite and a film that we focus really heavily on in the television, A Year in Film version of season one. And she hasn't spoken a lot about this film. She didn't speak a lot about this film. She did retire from acting. You know, you can Google pictures of her at Cannes in 1980, and she's posing with, like, Brooke Shields and, you know, all the Brat Pack, or the people that would become the Brat Pack a few years later. She just kind of retreated from acting because, as she said, it wasn't like this big decision that she was like, I feel exploited or anything like that. It was that she wasn't getting roles because the kinds of films that had roles for teen girls were going to the Molly Ringwalds, and those were the kinds of stories and films like this were not being made. And I think that's entirely true, that by like 83, the Foxes and the Little Darlings and the Out of the Blues and the Hey Babes are virtually gone, and we have the stupid like
Pretty in Pink. It's the revisionist fairy tale version of what teens are, which for some reason the Breakfast Club becomes the gold standard of what a teenager is.
I mean, you got to understand.
I know. I do understand. If you had shown this to me as a child, I think it would have been an act of like child abuse. It's that traumatic.
Yeah. But, it's like you might kill yourself.
I don't know. I understand what she was saying. Like, I think a lot of people wrote about her as though she'd been exiled, and she kind of just was like, no, I just stopped getting good jobs and it made sense to have kids and raise
my
children. She
chose to fade away rather than burn out.
Yeah, I guess.
Sorry, I'm going back to it.
Terrible. I will also say it's very worth looking up those
cute
photos from Cannes.
Like, Brooke Shields is in this pretty frilly dress and she's there in this like all denim, like looks like Dennis Hopper, basically.
Yeah, and the ones of her, well, her and there's one
that's
where her and Dennis Hopper are wearing matching
photo
outfits,
I wanna,
which is
like,
very charming.
License it and print it, and
yes,
and she looks like joyous next to him, like they look like they're having
a
blast.
Just, you know,
so.
A snapshot of something inaccurate.
I mean, I'm also.
This seems like it was a really collaborative thing. Like, it seemed like he really respected her. He got it, and she respected him and got it. And they were working on the same, like, frantic wavelength.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why the magic happens, because it's just the tension
of two
rubber bands
really
just going, right?
Loved making the movie. Yeah.
Look
too,
at what she did.
Good.
She was she got cast in a fucking made-for-TV, like, after-school special, and she produces this.
She was too real.
Well, I mean, if you want to know the real Linda Mintz thing, I want to watch
I've heard of it.
Lasted a few episodes. There's photos of it.
You know, she
it
shows up in Gummo.
Like,
she's the
life.
Mom in
I'm
Gummo.
Very fascinated.
So Harmony Korine, that's one of her.
Yeah. And because Harmony Korine, like, I think Harmony Korine 100%.
So, I mean, she does have a bit of a, it's not a renaissance, but certain directors pick her out. Well, after she retired and gave her roles.
I think he worked very hard just to get her. I read a bit
she
of
the looks
the
same
stuff. Yeah,
and it's
I think
20 years later.
Yeah. She looks so
upsetting.
Young. That's the crazy thing. She looks,
All right. I'm going to call it at that point. These are both films we think people should see as the restorations are coming. They're coming. We know. So, Alicia Fletcher, thank you for coming and being traumatized once again. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Usually I have a send out that's a funny throwback, and I've got nothing. Nothing, Becky. I have nothing.
All right.
Ma'am.
I do appreciate you've been talking about the film Foxes and you're wearing a
lovely
Foxes.
I didn't think about
today,
that.
So
I'm wearing
you
a
for
Fox
bringing
jumpsuit.
The
that's true.
Beautiful.
And Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us once again.
No problem. Like I say, open YouTube, Dennis Hopper's Russian Dynamite Death Chair. That's all you need to Google.
Oh, this has been the best episode. All right. And you can join us next week where we're going to have even more shocking material. We've got Emily Gagné from We Really Like Her coming back to the show. And we're going to be looking at a John Carpenter favorite and Adrienne Barbeau, too. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagné. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.